Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, sitting across from a bicoastal gentleman who you may know from many of his novels. One of my favorites was Wake Up, Sir, which brings to mind his new series on Starz. His first show was on HBO, Bored to Death. His new show is Blunt Talk. I'm, of course, sitting across from novelist and executive producer and creator Jonathan Ames. Jonathan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. We did an event at the LA County Museum with the show and ran the first couple of episodes. And one of the things I told you I liked about what you've been able to do in these two shows is make both L.A. and New York seem like small towns, like these villages that that your protagonists kind of have the run of. And I think that's a really kind of interesting, quaint feel for the shows.
Yeah, well, this friend of mine, this director, said he directed some episodes of Bored to Death. And he said you kind of made everyone feel like, not that it was hard to do, like, that New York was beautiful, or, you know, like, that it was like our it was like our town, like out of Thornton Wilder or something like that. And I wasn't aware that I did that, but I think it there is some impulse, especially with making comedies, to like kind of want to make the cities sort of feel sort of magical and maybe more benign than they actually are. It's a little bit of a fantasy.
But I think you managed to do the same thing with L.A. and Blunt Talk. It seems like a much smaller place to me.
Well, I had a lot of fun shooting in L.A. I mean, that's partly why I set the show here, because for 3 years of Bored to Death, kind of was like having a lot of fun, like, you know, in walking around the neighborhoods where I lived in Brooklyn, being, oh, I want to shoot here, I want to shoot here. You know, stuff that hadn't necessarily been showcased before, like the Gowanus Canal or even Grand Army Plaza, you know. So from, you know, the obscure to the not obscure in Brooklyn. But I did 24 episodes. I don't know how many minutes. That's, you know, probably about
28 minutes episodes.
Maybe 9 feature films worth of shooting in Brooklyn. And so then I was like, well, let me go to L.A. And there, of course, so much beauty here. Let me find really interesting exteriors to shoot in. And you know, went from things like the Venice Canals to, you know, being on top of Griffith Park to, you know, more obscure locations. Also, you said you had watched a bunch of the episodes, you know, found one of the hidden staircases, you know, that are all on the east side, which where I live now, and I just was mesmerized by all these staircases.
So that's kind of weird, Silver Lake area, where you're going up and you don't know quite where you are. It's sort of like San Francisco, but not really.
Yeah, no, these incredible staircases that I guess they built in the 20s when there were more trolley cars, and people would be dropped off at the bottom and like trudge home up these, you know, probably like 8 or 9 flights of stairs, really. I recently was going through a mental breakdown, and part of my personal cure was to run up the stairs, kind of like doing my own sort of spiritual Rocky thing, as if I could purge the madness in me. Anyway, but we shot on one of those staircases, also as an homage to the music box with Lone Hardy.
Yeah. There are quite a few movie allusions in the show, but we should talk a little bit. You can tell the audience what Blunt Talk is about.
Well, Blunt Talk is about a cable news host played by Patrick Stewart named Walter Blunt. And so his show is called Blunt Talk. And it's, I guess, you know, one always wants to make comparisons to other shows to make it easy for people in a sense, or make it easy for oneself. But the Larry Sanders Show kind of comes to mind, because on one hand, it's about this cable news host, but we're mostly living behind the scenes, you know, with his staff, which is like a family, and his personal life. But it's a little bit also about the world of the news. And I've called it a cross between P.G. Woodhouse and Network.
I told you, because when I saw the episodes, his network is UBS. And the first thing I thought of was Network. In the very first episode, in fact, there are a few allusions to Network, right down to him passing out.
Yeah, well, I watched Network before writing this. And I was kind of like, when I rewatched Network, I was mostly mesmerized by Howard Beale. And a lot of the movie focused on William Holden and Faye Dunaway, which was great. I mean, I love Faye Dunaway in that role. I mean, she was like so interesting with her, erotic life, and Holden was always mesmerizing. But I was like, I want to know more about Howard Beale. And so Blundtag is, in a sense, a chance to find out, if you have a newsman that's slightly cracked, what's his personal life like? Because we never got to see Howard Beale's apartment or what was going on back at his house. And so Walter Blunt is a little bit less mad than Howard Beale, but certainly in the first episode, he's kind of like Howard Beale at his apex of craziness. Then Walter settles down and we have a season and he kind of, you know, reconstitutes himself. But yeah, I named the network UBS for people that knew network, because kind of like, all right, here's this network yet again that's got a host going nuts, you know, like in this alternative universe, like with DC Comics, or you know what I mean? Like this was like this alternative universe where there is this place UBS. And then of course I did have him pass out because I loved it. Like Howard Beale was always passing out. He would get so passionate and I guess he would have like a kind of little air bubble in his brain and he would just pass out.
It's the truth. My guest who just brought in the Earth 2 UBS network to show Blunt Talk is Jonathan Ames. The show's on Stars. I guess one of the things I so like about what you do, and even as a writer, just sort of thinking about the way you deal with definitions of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And I guess I find myself thinking about that just because this show, some of the things in Walter's head go from him being in a musical to him sort of thinking about Burt Lancaster in two different guises, mm-hmm. As a circus artist and in The Swimmer, which mm-hmm. brings together film and literature mm-hmm. and the most masculine mm-hmm. man in the history of movies mm-hmm. who happened to be a great actor. It's these ideas, and almost if you could look back at Bored to Death, between this kind of three leads, you had like three mm-hmm. different, almost like the three ages of man between mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder where that comes from for you, the idea of people kind of reaching for these definitions of masculinity for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's all very potent stuff. I don't know. So as soon as you were talking about it, I'm like, what makes a man? And then, you know, I thought, well, I don't know what I can say on NPR. But I, you know, with Bored to Death, I remember when we looked at the three guys, I once saw, you know, that poster that you would see as a kid in science class, the evolution of man, you know, and it was kind of like it was George, Jonathan, and Ray, you know, there were these three forms of man, and now I have Walter Blunt. I mean, I like to play around with what's masculine or not masculine. I mean, I guess, you know, I've never read 50 Shades of Grey, but it really is sort of a brilliant title when you think about it, you know, that there is all this gray with who we are and what we are. And so Walter Blunt dreams of Burt Lancaster. And that was just like this weird inspiration that came to me. Originally, I wanted his dream to be of Fellini's La Strada, because I'd been obsessed with this moment when the great actress who was the star of La Strada, as she drives off on the back of Zampano's motorcycle, she waves goodbye to these nuns. And I saw like her face change in just one shot from kind of this smile of a goodbye to sadness. And I was always struck by like this acting of just this one shot. And so later I had Walter Blunt do many emotions in a single face, again, as an homage to her. And but then
he does it in the pilot.
Right. So I had him do many faces because I saw in one shot so many emotions cross her face, or so I imagined. I recently rewatched La Strada and was like, you know what? There's not quite as many emotions as I recalled. But anyway, it's still one of my favorite films of all time because, again, you know, you have the fool, you have the strong man, and you have the innocent. And it was just such a beautiful film. So anyway, I couldn't get the rights to La Strada to have that be what he dreams. And then for some reason, I'm like, the trapeze with Burt Lancaster. I don't know why. And because Walter is like, you know, flying through the air and losing his grip. And so the opening of Trapeze is perfect because you see Burt Lancaster flying through the air and then losing his grip and falling. And then later, I had wanted to film Patrick Stewart kind of doing an homage to The Swimmer, going from pool to pool, you know, and where he lives. I think we've set him in Pasadena, actually, and that's where his house is, where we filmed. But then, you know, to actually get many pools and to shoot many pools would have been very difficult. So I was like, I'll just put in a clip from The Swimmer and I'll get more Burt Lancaster, who is, I think, just about my favorite film star of all time.
I mean, that idea of that kind of masculinity and sensitivity. I mean, that somebody could do trapeze and Elmer Gantry and the leopard in the same career.
Yeah, he was an incredible actor. I mean, I'm not saying anything new, but I wonder, you know, yeah, just this issue of masculinity. I like to play with it and have it not be scary for people to have gray areas. In fact, when you said to me, I was bi-coastal. I had written this line for the Bored to Death movie that hasn't happened, but George Christopher was, or someone was talking about Richard Antrim, played by Oliver Platt, and someone says, my God, he's bi-coastal, bisexual, and bipolar. There's no stopping him. I like the idea of like that he had these three bis, you know, bi-coastal, bipolar, and bisexual, and he was just like out of control.
But I like that, if you mention that, that idea of this kind of emotional ambition that runs in your work, that people want to do and try so many things, and there tend to be these two-sized people who act as kind of an id, and there's kind of this super ego, and that I think is always so much fun in that. You have so much fun with that.
Well, yeah, I think I literally put it on display when I have Walter Patrick Stewart interview himself. It's kind of like his super ego is like, you are sexually out of control, and I guess the id is going, I know, I'm sorry, you know, and because we all have these punitive voices in our head, which I guess is the super ego. And I've recently I'm very intrigued by psychoanalysis and Buddhism recently in the most like baby step sort of way, and they're so similar in their approach, though, I think, again, using different terminology, but I think it's very much about trying to make the superego more compassionate for the id, to be kinder, you know, and I think that's the goal of both analysis and meditation, seems to be to have a less cruel voice in one's mind. And then if you have a less cruel voice in your own mind towards yourself, then you can show greater compassion to others.
That idea, though, of cruelty and the way it affects people, and I think even the way it affects men, is also something that kind of runs through your work, too. And we really see it play out here in Blunt Talk, don't we?
Well, I would imagine so. I mean, like, we all, again, I'm just repeating myself, but we're very hard on ourselves. And maybe, you know, women are just as hard on themselves as men. But, you know, in the male characters, we see that they berate themselves for falling short, you know. And, you know, I think it comes down to the erection. Again, when you were talking about masculinity, because, like, the man feels this pressure to produce the erection. And, you know, and it's like, I've got to do it, you know. But I think that permeates the rest of the male's life, too, that things become a series of erections that they have to manufacture. I don't know.
It's interesting because I think, and I find myself thinking back to so much of the stuff you've done, but here, Walter's looking for a sense of mission and some kind of purity. And I think he wants, in fact, when we see him in the pilot and this part of the show, he's reestablishing that sense of mission, trying to put himself back in where that erection can do some good, you know, figuratively speaking.
Yeah, well, he says, you know, after he really falters in the first episode and gets arrested, but sort of has been given a second chance because by collapsing on air, he gets great ratings. And so he's going to maintain his bully pulpit. And he says to Harry, his manservant, you know, the gods have given me a second chance. You know, I need to make the most of it. I need to be a better father to the American people and to my own children, he says. And so he wants to make a difference. And he also, he realizes his position of being at a news desk, he can get information out there that perhaps can tip things in a way that could help humanity, help the planet. But he's also aware, you know, it comes up in later episodes, that media and journalism is changing so much, and that the role of the news anchor and people actually watching the news, you know, it seems like so much we now just get through like Twitter and what's trending, you know, and you see someone's name. Have they died or do they have a new record out? You don't know, right? And you quickly click and that's it, right? But so he realizes that, you know, time is against him. And so he needs to seize this moment and do the best he can.
We'll take a break. More Talk of Two Messins with my guest, Jonathan Ames, whose new series on Stars is Blunt Talk. It's a treat, but there's more to come. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to the bizarre world of the treatment. I'm sitting across from Jonathan Ames, whose new show on Stars is Blunt Talk. But it's, I guess when we were talking at LACMA, one of the things I said was I thought that maybe Harry was imaginary just because I had just reread Wake Up, Sir. Mm-hmm. And in the pilot, we're not kind of sure if his valet is real or not. You said that was even something that other people had mentioned to you.
Yeah, well, when people read the script and not even having read Wake Up, Sir, they would say to me, is Harry the manservant imaginary? Like, because I guess it was such an absurd figure to sort of put into this world, you know, a guy who's, he has one change of costume the whole season. There's some variations. I mean, you know, at some point he has a sweater at night, kind of like Mr. Rogers, to read to Walter. But the rest of the time he's in this kind of beautiful black suit. And then I guess when he cooks, he wears an apron. When he shaves Walter, he's got a little barber's jacket. But when they have a party, he puts on a nice blazer and a turtleneck. But so I think it was just so out of place, this manservant in this, you know, okay, UBS Network, Patrick Stewart, Walter Blunt, you know, all seems very real. But wait, he's got a valet who's trailing after him at all times, who drives him, who tucks him in at night, cooks for him, you know. So it just seems so silly that people thought maybe he was imaginary. Now, in my novel, Wake Up, Sir, I never answer the question whether or not he's imaginary. When people would ask me, I would say, well, what character in fiction is real? Because they would say to me, is Jeeves, I name the character Jeeves, is he real? And I would say, what character, you know, in fiction is real? And then I liked people to come up with their own answers for that. But, and so I did... you know, steal and borrow from myself by putting a manservant in Blunt Talk. And I'm not sure why I did that. You know, when you write a pilot, you kind of think, well, it's probably never going to get made. And so you kind of, you know, you put in some of your old moves in a sense, or some of your comfort foods or something. And writing the dialogue between, you know, a master and his manservant was just always fun for me. And so I kind of resuscitated it. And maybe I despaired that I would ever be able to write a proper screenplay for the book. And so I kind of put that relationship into Blunt Talk. But what's fun for me is the novel Wake Up, Sir. There was kind of, I don't want to use this term lightly, but there was sort of a fatwa against me in England. No, I'm joking. But
I know what you mean, but because you're using the name Jeeves?
Well, yeah, because I had, you know, it was such an homage to Woodhouse.
Sure.
And so the publisher told me they could never sell the book in England. And in fact, the Woodhouse Society here in the U.S. wrote nasty things about me in their newsletter, you know, saying... They came to a reading of mine at Barnes & Noble.
Is that why it was just published recently in the UK?
Well, this wonderful publisher called Pushkin Press, like, stumbled across the book and said, we'll publish it, and it's done really nicely in England, and people have embraced it. But the Woodhouse Society here in the U.S., which one of their members, you know, attended a reading of mine at Barnes & Noble, and the opening line was, Jonathan Ames has none of Plum's charm. People who are, you know, real Woodhouse fans call him Plum. And then I was like, I was part of the Moth at the time, and I did some storytelling event at the New York Public Library, and this older lady said to me, I'm a member of the Woodhouse Society, and I love your book. And I said, really? Because I've heard they're against me. And she goes, I know, but I can't get any of them to read it. They just, you know, consider it a sacrilege. So, I mean, my stuff is so light as, you know, feather that I couldn't ever have an actual fatwa. But, you know, so having the Woodhouse Society against me was the closest I could come to Rushdie's sort of stirring things up. Not that you would ever want a fatwa.
No, but that's exactly the kind to have if you were to have a fatwa. Mm-hmm. You want it from the Woodhouse Society, who will probably still, like, press your pants and make you scones as they were trying to go against you.
Actually, that just sort of reminds me of a line I was forced to cut from Bored to Death. When George has a restaurant in season 3, I think they spot Salman Rushdie in the corner, because there was a certain point in New York where I was seeing Salman Rushdie everywhere. He just was out having a great time, and so there was some sort of line, you know, when you've had a fatwa, you like, when a fatwa has been lifted, you like to get out, or something like that. It was something a little bit better than that, and someone made me cut it, you know. But
I'm glad you got a chance.
Yes, yeah, so I'm putting it here.
As you were talking about this, I was thinking one of the things that's really fun about Blunt Talk for me is that for everything, Walter is kind of a stage show. So he has a costume for everything. Mm-hmm. He has a costume for AA. Mm-hmm. He has a and I just like this idea that everything is kind of a dress-up thing for him. Mm-hmm. And that's for me, again, that gets back to this whole kind of boys' book of adventure, kind of a P.G. Woodhouse thing, too, where Birdie mm-hmm. sort of getting a costume to go out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like that idea of the world being this place where people dress up mm-hmm. and consider. But that was also the way things were kind of in Bored to Death, too. Mm-hmm. George would dress mm-hmm. for occasion. Mm-hmm. And just look at this beautiful jacket you're wearing with the Doris pin on it right now. I like the idea that attire means something to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, you know, in my role as like the showrunner, which is kind of like being the director, one of the fun things is to sort of dress the characters. Now, I never played with Barbie dolls and Ken dolls, but I played with G.I. Joes, and I loved putting them in their different stuff. And then my era of G.I. Joes had the grippy hands, and I would have them in my closet, hanging onto clothing like they were climbing up vines on the side of a mountain or something. So there's something to getting to work with actors and getting to dress them, which is really fun. And I do think, yeah, there's a costuming going on. And when Walter goes to AA, Harry holds up two sets of options. He goes, we have your Peter Jennings look or your Bono. And he goes, for AA, definitely Bono. But I like to, and dressing the women too, we have a wonderful costume designer. It's just one more way to make the show visually fun. And then also in terms of costuming, though, you know, there is an element, good or bad, that, you know, we wear masks, we wear costumes, you know, that we are presenting ourselves to the world socially. And most of us do put some thought into it, or at least put on a costume that feels like armor. Like I've often described sport coats as a kind of armor. You know, by wearing the sport coat, I feel secure. It's also, for me, the sport coat is very much a male purse because I've got many pockets, I can hide all these things. Now, I'm wearing this Doris pin because my great aunt Doris passed away about a year ago, and she was very close to me. I was kind of her main guardian towards the end of her life. She made it to 101 and a half. And when I was cleaning out her room at the nursing home, I had this incredible experience. I got to be with her the last 6 days of her life and was alone with her, those last hours, and I had never witnessed that before. And it was both beautiful and heartbreaking. And anyway, when I was cleaning up her room after, I found like this old name tag from one of her jobs or something that had made it to her nursing home. You know, she almost had no stuff in the nursing home by then. And so I was wearing it in my pocket just for good luck. And then I was doing this interview in New York for Blunt Talk, and they pointed out that I had a stain on my front pocket from a marijuana vaporizer pen, which had leaked at some point. So I took out the Doris thing and put it over the stain. But then later I shifted it up onto further up my lapel because someone thought it might look good there. So anyway, it began as a stain covering. And then I'm just glad to have her with me all the time.
But that idea of not letting go and that the past is something that you make your peace with is something that runs through your work too, isn't it?
I think trying to accept the past and accept one's mistakes, you know, it's very hard.
I guess one of the things I want to ask you about, I see a connection because you brought Jason Schwartzman back as a recurring character in Blunt Talk. And one of the things I like about watching both him and Patrick Stewart is they have this brio. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much presence, and they really throw themselves into the material in a way that just makes it, I mean, but they're not sending it up. I mean, they're completely playing it as if it were real. Mm. And that's got to be so much fun to have you have these two guys together.
It was great. I mean, Jason is a dear friend, and I miss him even when I'm with him. You know, I just love the guy.
The two times I've seen you in the past before we did the show, I saw you with Jason.
Yeah, well, he's my dear friend, and Patrick is my new friend. And seeing the two of them work together, they were amazing together. And again, a film homage, and Jason has often reminded me of a young Al Pacino, which is why I used to, costuming and playing with dolls, I began to slick his hair back in Bored to Death so that he would look like, you know, Al Pacino in, you know, the Godfather movies and stuff. And so so I did a Dog Day Afternoon homage in towards the end of the season with Jason, and he was on fire. And Patrick, like Jason, but
it's a very slow build to that over the course of the season.
Yeah,
too.
And Jason was on fire, and Patrick was like this lion tamer with the two of them. And then also there was like a sweetness between the two characters too. I don't want to give things away, but that was a lot of fun for me to have Jason on the set of Blunt Talk and getting to work with him again and then pairing him with Patrick. So that was a great couple of days when having him on set.
But there's this wonderful intensity they both kind of have too. And again, it's fun to see Jason's character, who's the sweetest, most low impact hippie in the world, become this other person over the course of the show.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with, I think, great actors or people that, you know, jump out with. I mean, you know, now I feel like television is like film, especially with everyone watching things on HD with these big screens, you know, that the great actors, I think there's a German word, you know, there's a spirit inside them, and they're like a faucet, you know, and they're able to open up and just let it pour out of them through their eyes, through their fingertips, you know, the way they say the lines, you know. Acting is so hard. It's so hard to be not self-conscious. And all the actors on Blunt Talk are incredible. Our whole cast is amazing. I mean, Jackie Weaver, Adrian Scarborough, Tim Sharp, Dolly Wells, Mary Holland, Karin Soni, Patrick Stewart, I mean, Richard Lewis, Romany Malco. I mean, these people are free. You know, once the scene begins, they are free. And it's and very lucky to have that. And then, you know, people like Jason and Patrick, you know, they have wonderful careers because they're able to let that charisma out.
But in seeing them together especially, there's such a sense of pleasure these two guys get from acting, and that pleasurable feeling that acting offers them really kind of radiates out to us as viewers, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, both of them, I mean, and you hear Patrick, you know, you think Patrick Stewart, Shakespeare, he loves to be other people. He loves to make believe. He loves to pretend. You know what I mean? And I guess that's the childlike quality with actors, you know, that they like to pretend. This is fun for them to pretend. Patrick Stewart is happiest when he's sitting behind that desk reading from the monitor, pretending to be a newscaster. I mean, so he could be a 14-year-old kid who's like wanting to pretend to be an astronaut and getting a big kick out of it. Now, when I was a little kid, I used to, you know, tie a towel around my neck so it would look like a cape, and I'd go running into the woods near my house and I felt like I was flying. Now, when I've acted, I'm very self-conscious. I'm a terrible actor. I can't free myself the way these people can. I used to do a lot of live performance in New York, and there I think I could free myself. But in front of the camera, the way these people let go, that's a special gift.
What a time. You have to come back. This has been so much fun. Thank you, well, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me and letting me say erection more than once.
I think I've got one now. My guest is Jonathan Ames, whose new show on Starz is Blunt Talk. The show is recorded at NPR West by Peter Stenchel. The show is mixed by Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Wright, who's the associate producer. I'm pretending to be a talk show host. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.